Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 495th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Canada.
Took a little while to remember exactly.
It was, yes, yeah.
Who employed you? I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta. And we still have back with us, still, after one whole previous podcast, we invited Ricky back, mostly because he can't find work elsewhere.
Yeah. And we're not paying him.
And we're not paying him.
That's what's so enticing.
Mm-hmm.
Ricky, why don't you first say, find everyone a little bit about yourself.
Absolutely. So hi, everybody. My name is Ricky Tourjon. I'm an assistant professor at UBC and a clinical pharmacy specialist at St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver, BC.
And I think I'm not sure if we mentioned it in the previous podcast, but I think we may have mentioned that we're going to be doing something in the area of heart failure. And so we're going to do a few podcasts in this area. They may not be sequential, but we'll do a few of them. And we're going to start off with the one that's probably the most difficult to treat because not a whole heck of a lot of stuff works. But we're going to talk about heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And Ricky, you're going to sort of work us through what even that even means.
Absolutely. And just to kind of recap that then. So, you know, heart failure has taken a bit of an evolution over the years. We used to kind of we've got different ways of subdividing it by symptoms, by cause. But perhaps more importantly, with regards to treatment, we typically classify heart failure based on ejection fraction. And even that's taken an evolution over the years. But sort of this year, there's been finally a universal agreement, at least internationally. So you can classify heart failure essentially in three big groups. There's heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. So that's heart failure with an ejection fraction of 40% or less. There's this new classification called mildly reduced ejection fraction. So that's 41 to 49%. And then preserved ejection fraction, which is 50% or more. I'll just say off the top that a lot of the studies that we're going to be talking about today are a bit of a mix of the last two categories. So it gets a bit muddy.
And I was going to say, I bet it took an unbelievably long time to come up with low, medium, and high.
Scholars in the field of heart failure.
Yeah, they struggled for decades over this.
They probably did, James.
Oh, I am not exactly. These things take forever, but it's nice that
Yeah.
But anyway, so we're gonna work with people who have an ejection fraction at least primarily above 40%, but I think you're gonna say sometimes above 50%, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think today we're going to focus mainly on preserved ejection fraction with an asterisk that sometimes we'll be talking about that mildly reduced group.
Yeah, okay.
And Ricky's going to turn heart failure into heart success for us.
Great.
Nice.
See what we did there? We turned it around for you, Ricky.
So, yes. Thanks.
Take it away.
Good.
Thanks.
So since we're focusing on heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, I think the most important caveat is that historically this has basically been sort of a category, a diagnosis of exclusion, and is a really big bucket. So I think we're going to post these slides online, but we've just got, there's this pretty crazy looking algorithm, as Mike mentioned, is going to mention that, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction really has a whole ton of different causes, and a lot of them are wildly different. So it can be a valve problem, it can get a pericardial problem. I could go on, but I'll put you guys to sleep. But suffice it to say that it is a very heterogeneous group of people, and so when you try to study it, it becomes very difficult because it is probably more a combination of a lot of different conditions.
Yeah. And as we talked about earlier, that makes it tricky in that if we have treatments that maybe would work for one type and then not the other type, then and when you add them all together, you may either see wildly good results or not at all. And that's the tricky. But at present, right now, it's I don't think most of the studies categorize it as to the actual cause, right?
No, nothing gets that sophisticated.
Yeah.
If we think about the medication management for heart failure, you know, when we think about heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, and we'll talk about this in the future, but there's just been an avalanche of options. And many of the drugs that we have looked at for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction in that group tend to reduce, if not mortality, at least they reduce heart failure hospitalizations. And a lot of the drugs that have been tried in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction have not had that success. And in fact, most of them have, you know, generally failed.
Yeah. And so And like the ones that we're all familiar with, the beta blockers, the digoxin nitrates, I can't even know how to pronounce variciguat. I don't know how to pronounce that one. ACEs and ARBs and the mineralocorticoids and so on. And those, Michael, you were talking about earlier, we have so many that, you know, we could put people on 8 drugs in theory if we followed evidence-based protocols.
And they wouldn't thank you for it.
No. Well, they would, but they'd be lying down, you know, in an unconscious state probably. And so that's
Ricky made a good point recently at the PIPE conference that sometimes the heart is functioning so poorly that these medicines, when they're working, they're actually helping increase your blood pressure. But overall, it is a lot of pills. Yeah. And I think when we get to reduced ejection fraction, Ricky's going to talk about where your priorities are and because many people will not look kindly on 8 pills. Mm-hmm. 8 different medicines.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that when we get to that topic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, we're actually in the sort of opposite end of things where we don't have that many options. Now, I'll say it off the bat here, because it's not really based on much sort of clinical outcome evidence, but, you know, the backbone of managing heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, well, all heart failure, is really around decongestion with diuretics. Mm-hmm. We won't touch on that too much, I don't think, unless you guys want to talk more about it. But ultimately, that's really based on symptom relief and not so much on reducing hospitalization or other events. Diuretics have never been shown to do that for heart failure.
And you would use them in exactly the same way as you would if you had reduced ejection fraction.
Exactly. Now, people with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction just in general tend to be older, frailer, with more comorbidities, so they tend to be a bit more difficult to manage from a diuretic perspective, but otherwise the principles are the same.
Okay, yeah, great.
And then depending on the type, Ricky, you'll be targeting, you know, if it's hypertension induced, you'll be targeting hypertension. If there's a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, you can also target actual surgery, which can reduce the volume of the heart for valves. It's valves and blah, 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 like valve surgery, etc. So there are things potentially to do for preserved ejection fraction, but it's much of it doesn't have easy solutions, as you're pointing out. And there's just a handful, not even a handful, there's really a few possible meds to consider outside of diuretics.
That's right. And so, you know, the options that have been thrown around out there, either mentioned by, you know, the Kane guidelines or some other guidelines or mentioned in reviews, I'll just start off by mentioning them as options and then we can kind of dig through the evidence. So primarily we've got ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. We've got mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists like spironolactone. More recently, we've got the angiotensin receptor and neprilysin inhibitor, so that's sacubitril, valsartan, or Entresto, as you may know, is the brand name. And then even more recently now, we've got SGLT2 inhibitors like empagliflozin, and we'll talk about some of that evidence. So really, ultimately, those are options which have not been entirely futile.
That is a ringing endorsement.
Yeah. I could see that in an advertisement.
Yeah.
Yeah, this drug's not completely useless.
So, Ricky, why don't you take us through, because ACEs and ARBs are often seen as the kind of fundamental drug in or the foundation drug in heart failure. Why don't you take us through how they work for heart failure with preserved ejection fraction?
Oh, you want mechanism?
No.
No!
You know me better than that. What do we have as far as trials? Sure. So, you know, in terms of ACE inhibitors, it's mainly been very small studies that, you know, are primarily inconclusive. They're not worth mentioning too much, but the labeling of heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, it's kind of not, I don't want to say discovery, but it coming into vogue sort of came around the same time that ARBs came on the market. And so there's at least decently sized trials for those. In fact, there's two well-designed ARB studies that have looked at heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. The first is called CHARM Preserved, and that was using candesartan. Now, just to run you down a little bit into the sort of trial and how it was done. So this was a study of about 3,000 patients. It was a allocation-concealed, double-blind, well-done randomized control trial that enrolled patients who had symptomatic heart failure, so NYHA class 2 to 4, and an ejection fraction of 40%, of more than 40%. And so patients were randomized to either candesartan or placebo. They were started on a small dose of 4 to 8 milligrams a day, and then attempts were made to uptitrate them to a target dose of 32 milligrams a day, which is kind of your expected sort of max dose that's on the market. And patients were followed up for a median of 3 years. And at the end of that follow-up, this trial was essentially a neutral trial, at least as far as it goes for the primary outcome. So the primary outcome was, I believe, cardiovascular death and heart failure hospitalization, which is a pretty standard outcome in heart failure studies. And, you know, in essence, the group, the candesartan group, had a risk of the primary outcome of about 22% compared to 24.3% with placebo, and that was not statistically significant. So then, you know, the article basically boils down to subdividing it, looking at secondary outcomes. And in fact, when you do that, the outcome of heart failure hospitalization was reduced by about 3.3% in absolute terms in the trial. Now, that doesn't come without harms. So there are side effects, of course. So there are more discontinuations because of hypotension, hyperkalemia, increases in creatinine, things that you would expect from ARBs. Important thing to point out is that, at least as far as it goes with the Canadian guidelines, they actually specifically recommend candesartan in people with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. This was from, you know, the 2017 Canadian guidelines, but they specifically recommend candesartan as the ARB to use in this patient population. Now, I'll point out why that's interesting is because there is a second ARB study that's actually, if anything, larger. And that's the iPreserves trial. So it used irbesartan. And this one was slightly different. So you had about 4,500 patients, again, with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And in this case, they had a cutoff for ejection fraction of 45% or more. And the average was about 60%. So again, we're looking at irbesartan compared to placebo. And at the end of 4 years with this trial, so it was both larger and longer than the candesartan study, there was no difference in the primary outcome of cardiovascular death and cardiovascular hospitalization. There's no reduction in death, and there was no reduction in heart failure hospitalization either. So two contrasting studies of the same class of drugs, at least, not the same agent, but the same class of drugs, mostly neutral, though.
And that it always makes it kind of tricky when you have drugs from the same class of therapy, they don't really have that much. They're not that different because they both didn't show anything originally, and then one just happened to do sort of a look at one specific endpoint and found a difference. And you know, for almost all, you know, any time you talk to people about evidence, you know, they say if the primary endpoint was not different, then really it was, there is nothing to go for, and so I don't see them being all that different, but it is interesting how guidelines would just basically have to hang their hat on this one secondary outcome in, you know, this one medication.
Yeah, it is. It's very interesting because this is the, you know, with this kind of borderline result for the reasons that James indicated, there wasn't much difference in the primary outcome. it was close, but not different. And then the heart failure hospitalization one was slightly reduced. You think to yourself, well, it'd be great to have a confirmatory study. And we had that study, which confirmed, at least in irbesartan's case, it doesn't work. And so it really makes me wonder if I was in heart failure, would I jump to, take candesartan?
Yeah. And even if the effect was real, we're talking about a 3% difference in hospitalization.
Oh, yeah. Over 3 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
So about 1% a year, if you guessed.
Which is not zero, but 1% per year is as close as you can get to zero using whole numbers.
Thank you for that math.
Yeah. That's math three, grade three.
So Ricky, you've mentioned what the guidelines suggest. I don't think I understand where they come from, actually. I mean, when you're faced with a patient in front of you and they've been sick, particularly if they've just had a hospitalization for heart failure, you're feeling quite, you really wish you had more you could do for them. So I can see where some of the docs would suggest this, but I don't know if this patient had a lower risk for hospitalization, if I would jump at it. So what about the next intervention? I mean, mineral corticoids are, again, as we've mentioned briefly, the kind of top three are before the SLGT2s came along, the mineral corticoids, the ACEs, ARBs, and beta blockers, they all have a very similar effect in a reduced ejection fraction. So might that manifest in the case of spironolactone? So the story of spironolactone and HFpEF is actually pretty interesting in general. I'll just add regarding the ARBs before we jump into the MRAs. Most people with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction typically have it because of hypertension. And so most of these patients end up, you know, at least when they come to me, they're at least on one blood pressure lowering agent. So a lot of these patients end up being on an ACE or ARB by default because of their comorbidities. Yes. So practically speaking, you know, using one of those agents as part of their hypertension regimen makes sense, even though this is pretty weak evidence considering it's a secondary.
It's kind of like a twofer.
It's a twofer, yeah.
Yeah.
Or that's exactly how it's lowering heart failure is the other thought.
Yeah.
But let's jump into the MRA stuff. So the use of spironolactone in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction primarily comes from the TOPCAT trial. So
now we have to stop right there, Ricky. Ricky, you have to acknowledge that name.
James has a song he wants to sing.
No, God,
right?
No, we're not doing anything like that. But it is
James is a poet, and that's his stage name is Top Cat.
Yeah, and we don't want to talk about what Mike's stage name is
because it's why.
Yeah, it's a bit sketchy.
Yeah, thanks. Nice transition. Back to you, Ricky, for Top Cat the study. Okay, so Top Cat was a. It's actually a government-funded study. Again, this is a allocation-concealed double-blind RCT, which is pretty much the rule of thumb with meds in heart failure. So this trial randomized about 3,400 patients with heart failure with an ejection fraction of 45% or more, with an average of about 55%. And these patients also had to have other sort of enrichment criteria. So they had to either be hospitalized for heart failure in the last year or had to have elevated natriuretic peptide, so an elevated BNP or NT-proBNP. I won't mention the exact number because that varies from study to study, but it had to be elevated by their criteria. The other interesting thing is that within this trial, they had to have quote-unquote controlled systolic blood pressure, so either a systolic blood pressure less than 140 or less than 160 if they were on three or more meds. So they were trying to control here for the fact that spironolactone is going to lower blood pressure, and they didn't want this to just be a resistant hypertension study. So they randomized patients to spironolactone, and they started with a bit of an odd dose, so 15 milligrams a day with a target dose of 45 milligrams a day. And so that was compared to placebo, and patients were followed for an average of 3.3 years. At the end of the day, this is another neutral study for the primary outcome. So their primary outcome was cardiovascular death, aborted cardiac arrest, and heart failure hospitalization. And again, confidence interval, 95% confidence interval crossed one on the upper end. So for all intents and purposes, this was a neutral trial for the primary outcome. Although again here, when they looked at heart failure hospitalization specifically, this was reduced by 2.2% in absolute terms. So again, a slight reduction in heart failure hospitalization, but not in their primary outcome.
And it just reached statistical significance. You know, with a confidence interval on with one edge of 0.99, it doesn't mean it's not a valid difference, but boy, it just makes you so nervous when you start doing all these subset analyses.
So after that, you know, this was basically called a neutral study and enthusiasm wound down quite a bit. But the researchers tried to identify, you know, why was this a neutral study? And they started coming up with very interesting reports. So the first thing that they reported about a year later was the fact that they noted really big regional differences in the study. So this was done in North and South America, as well as Russia and Georgia. And so when they basically split patients on whether they were North or South American versus Russian or Georgian, they found quite a few differences. So people from Russia or Georgia were more likely to be enrolled if they'd been hospitalized for heart failure. They tended to have much lower risk of hospitalization or death. And so the question became whether these patients actually even had heart failure to begin with. And so if you looked at it from the perspective of just the North American subgroup, or North and South American subgroup, then there was a statistically significant difference in the primary outcome, but not if you looked at the Russians and Georgians. Now, of course, this is a subgroup analysis and caveats around that, but it did raise some sort of fishiness about the data and the generalizability of the study.
Yeah, lots of interesting things, because they're different in a couple ways. It's not just the primary outcome, but the adverse events of hyperkalemia were more common in the American arm than the Russia-Georgian arm.
That's right. And so that last point you make about the hyperkalemia raised a concern as to whether patients were actually even getting the drug. So again, a couple of years later, the TOPCAT investigators came back with another paper basically looking at patients' canrenone levels, which is a metabolite of spironolactone. So we can use it to see if they've even got, you know, drug in their body. And what they found was that, you know, within the people in Russia that they tested that in, of those patients who said they were definitely taking spironolactone, about 30% of them had no detectable canrenone in their blood, compared to about 3% in the U.S. and Canada. So then the additional concern became that maybe these patients weren't actually even getting study drug and everybody in Russia was actually getting the placebo drug. That was one of the sort of, not accusations, but that was one of the concerns raised by the authors in this. Bottom line, though, it's kind of interesting, but bottom line is, you know, the main study is still neutral, and it's challenging to identify if we can't trust, you know, two of the study countries, can we trust the results in general? But ultimately, what this has led to is now there are more studies looking at spironolactone in heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, because this isn't considered sort of the nail in the coffin for the use of this drug in heart failure.
And it'll be fascinating to see those results, right? Because, you know, it's great that you do all of this investigative stuff, but, you know, none of this would have been planned ahead of time, and you're just sort of trying to figure out. And I think it's a legitimate thing to do. You know, hear it here first. Sometimes studies don't actually go, they don't run the way they're supposed to. And so, you know, that I think it's a legitimate thing to go down that path, but to attribute the fact that the reason that it didn't work was because they didn't take it is really a difficult thing to prove. And I think the evidence will be in the next studies that come out. So I think it's legitimate to do one of those based, I guess, on the controversy that's here.
So I think it's legitimate for them to look at this. I mean, there, James, you indicated that a lot of studies, things don't happen exactly as you plan. And we've joked in the past about some countries being a better place to run research because people do what you ask them to do, and therefore you get a better, because you get better adherence to treatment and to non-treatment, that you can actually tease out differences if they exist. One of my favorite examples of this is prostate cancer screening. The first Quebec study, which people were putting a lot of weight on, had 24 in the screen group, only 24% even went for screening once versus 7% in the unscreened. And compare that to the US study where 85% went for screening in the screening arm, but 50 something went for screening in the non-screening arm. And the same is true. And I remember reviewing for PrEP therapy for HIV prevention, some studies, the adherence to the drug was far less than 50% and so on. And so this is it's a common problem, why things might not work out in the final study, that doesn't have to do with the intervention actually being ineffective. It's that we just don't even have an answer yet.
I agree. And when Rick and I were just talking earlier about this, where you go, the problem is it's not so big of a problem in this one where there's just two different groups of countries that you're looking at. But, you know, there are multiple trials that use dozens of different countries. And if you were to do a subset analysis of each country, even a treatment that works in some countries, it would look like there was actually harm. Just, you know, because if you start looking at all these different subsets, you might find something. So it is very tricky, but that's basically where we stand with the mineralocorticoids.
Yeah.
So why don't we just do the Paragon, and then we'll leave everyone. It'll be like a cliffhanger at the end when we go, and we'll talk about the ones that might have some benefit after that.
Sounds good. So Paragon HF was study of sacubitril valsartan in heart failure with, again, preserved or mildly reduced ejection fraction. So, again, another double-blind randomized controlled trial. This one had about 4,800 patients, heart failure, and then ejection fraction of 45% or more. Again, this is another trial like TOPCAT that had some additional criteria. So patients had to have an elevated NT-proBNP or BNP or a recent heart failure hospitalization. And on top of that, they also had to have some sort of structural abnormality on their echo, either left atrial enlargement or left ventricular hypertrophy. So again, just a few extra criteria that point to this being more cardiac rather than shortness of breath from another non-cardiac condition. So patients in this trial actually had to go through an active run-in phase. So they had to tolerate basically max dose valsartan, then max dose sacubitril valsartan, and then they were randomized to one or the other. This was about a three-year study. And at the end of the day, again, this is another study that was not statistically significant, or the difference for the primary outcome was not statistically significant. And so you look at it from a relative perspective, that's a hazards ratio of 0.87, goes from 0.75 to 1.01. And in absolute terms, you're looking at an annual risk of cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalization of 12.8% with sacubitril valsartan compared to 14.6% with valsartan. So about a 1.8% reduction per year in theory here, if it were different. Other than that, there's no difference in death overall or cardiovascular death. The one outcome that does stand out, and again, this is a secondary outcome considering a neutral primary outcome, but there was an improvement in the number of patients who had a clinically important improvement in their quality of life. So 33% compared to 30% with valsartan. Things to point out with this study. So again, this is another neutral study, but what people have really focused on after the publication of this study was the fact that there were some interesting subgroup differences. Specifically, women but not men seem to benefit, again, in subgroup analysis. And those with an ejection fraction that was on the lower end, in this case, lower than the median, had a reduction in the primary outcome, whereas those who had a higher ejection fraction did not.
Did they study the subgroups with comorbid onchomycosis? The challenge is you're interpreting these when, like, as James has pointed out, and you have, that they're borderline. Like, I was going to make a positive comment about these things, how close they are to finding a benefit, many of them. But to then go searching for subgroups and to say, you know, I think we should be treating women with sacubitril, I don't know. I think it's a bit hopeful, yeah, that this is real.
And there's been evidence that's looked at when you do sort of a subset analysis and then you redo a study to see if that subset analysis was real. The vast majority of the time, it isn't.
No, yeah, absolutely it's not.
Yeah, so
once you've analyzed, and I was joking about the onychomycosis, because you can subsplit people literally thousands and thousands, if not an infinite number of ways, and you can find stuff, because once you do 20 of these or so, you're approaching a high probability of finding something falsely.
Yeah.
I just worry about that when the benefits aren't there in the overall group. Now, that said, for the last interventions that we've reviewed or that you've taken us through, Ricky, they've all been, or most of them have been, except perhaps the irbesartan, but the other ones have all been trending, and I know you love that, James, trending towards benefit, like in the kind of somewhere around a 0.9 hazard ratio, 0.85 hazard ratio, where there's some positive effect, but they're not reaching statistical significance. Yeah. So,
There might be something there, but then when you see that, I mean, the absolute differences are just so tiny, relatively speaking.
Well, like we joked about, 1% per year, right? They might be there, and they're small. But are we desperately looking for? Like, I know that as a clinician, I have historically felt handcuffed when presented with these patients, and we have them in numbers that we just don't have near as much to do for them, and been tempted by even small reductions. And so I understand where we're searching for these, but I think we have to be careful and keep in mind what actual effects we're having.
Yeah, no, exactly. So we've been sort of through the ACEs and ARBs, you know, again, only in particular the ARBs really didn't show much at all. Maybe hospitalizations of a couple percent, maybe two and a bit percent. The mineralocorticoids, with the TopCat, with all of the nuances of whether or not there was issues with how the trial was run, and then the sacubitril with the things that we just went over. But Rick, we didn't talk about beta blockers, the digoxin and other agents like that, but those have also been shown not to benefit, right?
That's right. At least one trial for each.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're basically, unlike these ones where you dig a bit more and there's maybe a difference there, for beta blockers and digoxin, it's been wholly neutral.
Yeah. So, I mean, Mike, I'm not sure why we did this, but this has been the most depressing podcast we've ever done. And I'm not sure whether it's the topic or Ricky, but
Let's blame Ricky because he's young and we resent that.
Yes, we do resent that. Yeah. But but I think you said it well, Mike. It is frustrating. You grab at something to try and help people. But the problem with doing that is we know that every one of these medications has the potential for risk, and they certainly have the potential for inconvenience and cost. And so,
and that risk is generally higher than the potential chance benefits. So it's not that I'm dismissing all of these, or that the guidelines who are looking for some way to kind of nuance the prescribing. I just think the nuance is reaching, and we have to accept that the benefits, if they exist, are very small. And that's okay. Okay if we acknowledge that and have a discussion with patients and prescribe them anyway. Like, as I've done, I've said to patients, I remember Charm
Preserved came out, and I had conversations with patients about the effects are small, but, you know, this person, these people that I'm recalling were sick, and, you know, maybe it's worth a shot. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, actually.
As long as we're not willing to accept any toxicity.
I think there's two key points, right? Is being honest about the expectations for the benefit, that it's not something that's going to, you know, reverse their condition or reduce their risk of dying. It may not even impact their quality of life, because we don't really have that data for heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. But the other thing is to have good monitoring in place, right? Especially with spironolactone. Unchecked, it's the risk of hyperkalemia and death from that can be very high, and so that needs to be put into place.
And I'm sure, you know, I agree with what Ricky says. If you can get the heart failure under slightly better control, you don't run into, say, as much necessarily blood pressure issues. But there is no doubt that people cannot tolerate. They eventually don't tolerate the doses that we use in these. We've talked about this in previous podcasts, and in fact, with some stuff that we've done with Ricky with dosing and heart failure, if you put people on these medications, a number of them will have blood pressure issues.
Mm-hmm. But you can, as you know, as you both know, you can prescribe lower than what was used. These benefits are marginal, but you'll still get most of that marginal benefit.
Yeah.
At a lower dose. So I think there's potential path forward, just recognizing the limitations of what we have, but we're leaving it on a happy note, because you're going to come back, Ricky, and tell us about some amazing therapies that completely rid patients of heart failure forever.
Yeah. And also I think it treats psoriasis too at the same time. It's a weird one.
No, but we are going to talk about ones that have some evidence, a little bit more benefit and a little bit, I would say, a little bit firmer findings, better findings on the clinical trials that maybe we can lean on a bit more.
So anything else, Ricky?
No, that's it. Looking forward to chatting about that.
Yeah, good. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.